quick, give me one word you would use to talk about this economy right now. Stick around. I'll tell you my choice. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risnall. It is Wednesday today, the 7th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There is a four-letter word well-suited to use in describing this economy of late. Data, people. Data. D-A-T-A. And I'm thinking here in particular of its use to the Federal Reserve, which meets next week to consider, again, what to do with interest rates. Raise them one more time? Skip a meeting, perhaps? Pause for a while longer? Whatever they are going to do, they will have had a slew of new data to consider since their last meeting, including an update on wages. Wage gains, that's the key part, right? Gains, they do seem to be moderating. Average hourly earnings up 4.3% year over year in May, still higher than before the pandemic, to be sure, but well off the pace a year ago of almost 6%. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports now to get us going, we've got some evidence that wages employers are offering for open positions, that is, to job switchers in this economy, they're rising more slowly now, too.
Job postings have been falling as the labor market gradually cools down from the red-hot hiring frenzy of the past few years. At the job site Indeed, which is a Marketplace underwriter, they're down more than 15% since last spring. And, says Director of Economic Research Nick Bunker,
wage growth is coming down.
It's still pretty strong, 5.3% on an annual basis last month, according to Indeed.
But that's a considerable slowdown when you compare it to what we're seeing at the beginning of 2022, when posted wages were growing about 9.3% year over year.
Now, keep in mind, advertised wages are often set pretty high to entice people who already have jobs. Bunker predicts these wage gains will keep slowing and reach pre-pandemic levels by early next year. Joe Galvin at small business advisory firm Vistage says employers are now facing less pressure to outbid each other as their workforces stabilize.
As CEOs downshift into a slowing economy, they are turning the dials at slowing of increase of headcount, not replacing open jobs.
Meanwhile, recent job cuts in tech, media, finance, and elsewhere have some workers worrying they'll face outright wage losses, says John Lear at Morning Consult.
Higher income workers are extremely nervous about their near-term job prospects. They increasingly expect to lose pay or income over the next 4 weeks.
But the situation's not so great at the opposite end of the income spectrum either. Wage gains are actually slowing the most for low-wage workers, says Indeed's Nick Bunker.
The tighter labor market let wages grow faster for workers at the bottom of the income distribution. And what our data suggests is that period of reducing inequality might be fading.
What's more, says Tulane economist Gary Hoover, prices are still rising faster than wages, meaning workers are falling further and further behind.
The drop back to normality in wages is preceding the drop in prices, which is actually putting those people at the bottom of the wage distribution at a disadvantage.
His biggest worry that job growth will also stall along with wage gains. Then there'll be more people with no income facing higher prices. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, and I recognize this is an awkward turn, there is a phrase you haven't heard a bit that's in the air, no pun intended, given New York, bull market. People, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sometimes corporate bankruptcy filings are straightforward. There's a filing, there's debtor relief, there's a reorg, and the company gets back to business. Happens all the time. And then sometimes there are retail bankruptcies, which often go a whole nother way. I mention that because Bed Bath & Beyond's journey through Chapter 11 continues. The company is said to be in talks to sell its baby product chain, Bye Bye Baby. But meanwhile, the home goods store BB&B itself is still on a path to extinction. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab explains why retail bankruptcies are just different.
There are enough fallen retailers out there to fill a graveyard. Sports Authority, Sam Goody, and remember Borders Books? The chain's expansion may have seemed borderless until it ran into Amazon.
If you look at the retail industry, the way that companies grow and decay is pretty rapid.
Santiago Galino is a professor of operations at Wharton.
And that's in part because of how dynamic the industry is, because of economic cycles, because of changes in the culture, changes in what customers want.
Yeah, businesses of all kinds are affected by fickle consumers. But because retailers are so close to consumers, unlike, say, manufacturers, they are the most affected. By the time a brand is so out of touch with technology or trends that it has to file for bankruptcy, customers have moved on. And in Chapter 11, companies have just 4 months to reimagine a business plan. It's why most retailers instead look for a buyer. And the buyer, it's going to evaluate what it's getting out of the deal. James Gellert is CEO of Rapid Ratings.
Well, you may be picking up leases and real estate, so you may have location.
Not a huge win, since Gellert says many retailers rent, not own.
But you're really betting on the brand name and a hopefully loyal customer base that wants to see you succeed.
And while if that customer base was that loyal, the company would likely not be in bankruptcy in the first place. So really, there isn't much in retail to acquire, unlike airlines that own planes, or manufacturers that own intellectual property rights, or car makers that own plants full of machinery. All retailers own are shelves full of stuff. Jared Elias researches corporate bankruptcy at Harvard Law.
It's very tempting for the creditors just to say, let's just generate some cash out of this thing, get the money that we need, and then we're done.
A liquidation sale is exactly what it sounds like. The company is going out of business. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This was kind of an economic good news, economic bad news day over in the UK. A report this morning from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development says the Brits are going to be dealing with one of the highest rates of inflation among G20 economies this year, 6.9%. On the other hand, as economists are wont to say, the OECD figures the UK is going to skate by without actually falling into a recession. But a slew of big companies over there have been complaining that the British economy is overregulated and excessively bureaucratic, which, if you can recall, lo these many years later, was something that Brexit was supposed to fix. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the latest in the long, long saga of post-Brexit Britain.
The boss of this steel company, Simon Boyd, is an ardent supporter of Brexit and not a happy man.
I'm rather disappointed to be sitting here today saying that Brexit still hasn't been delivered, but that remains the case.
And this, remember, is more than 3 years after the UK exited the bloc.
We've got to deliver Brexit.
The UK is, of course, out of the European Union, so that is Brexit, isn't it?
Well, that is Brexit in name, but we're still tied to the short tails. When you're going to cut something free, cut it free.
Boyd is dismayed that thousands of EU regulations that he says make his business less competitive than foreign steelmakers remain on the statute book, in spite of an earlier pledge by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak.
Mr. Sunak said he's for Brexit. He's going to reform all these 4,000 regulations. What's he doing? Not a lot.
The government says it needs more time to sift through the laws and says it'll scrap 600 of them by the end of the year. But there are broader concerns about post-Brexit Britain. A string of large corporations has accused the country of being anti-business, Microsoft among them. It angrily slammed the UK after the British regulator blocked the company's takeover bid for major American video gamer Activision. The EU regulator then okayed the deal. Brexit supporters were furious. Matthew Lesh of the Free Market Institute of Economic Affairs.
The UK has taken probably a more, even more aggressive line, kind of more aggressive anti-tech line than even the European Union.
He agrees with Microsoft that this sends a negative signal to international investors.
this is a missed opportunity for the UK to differentiate itself from the EU and be somewhere where it's easier to do business and it's easier to invest.
A sharp rise in the level of corporate tax, up to 25%, has compounded the impression that Britain has become less welcoming for business. Personal taxation is rising sharply too. The problem, says Ben Harris-Quinney, head of the world's oldest conservative think tank, the Bow Group, is that a conservative government has lurched to the left.
We have the highest taxes in 70 years. We have the highest level of spending. We have the highest level of regulation. We have the highest level of immigration in history.
And he says since the overwhelming majority of British politicians never really believed in Brexit, the government has not exploited the opportunities it offered to create a flexible, competitive economy.
It was really about divergence from the regulatory alignment we had with the European Union. The government has failed to deliver that.
The IMF has given the UK government credit for stabilising the economy after the wild gyrations last fall following the mini-budget of the previous Conservative Premier, Liz Truss. But the vast majority of Brits, according to the latest poll, blame the four successive Conservative governments for mismanaging Brexit. 75% of those polled agreed with the statement that Brexit had the potential for success, but government implementation made it fail. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Nah, we'll wing it. We'll do it live.
What could possibly go wrong? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 91 points today, about 0.3%, 33,665. The NASDAQ down 171 points, about 1.3%, 13,104. The S&P 500 subtracted 16 points, about 0.3%, 42.67. Big swaths of the eastern part of this country are experiencing poor air quality, poor being charitable there. It's vile. That's a good word. Because, of course, of the wildfires up in Canada, which got us thinking about air purifier companies. Whirlpool Corporation, which also makes air filters, ascended 6.3%. Honeywell International, which is a big maker of HEPA air purifiers, up 1%. Unilever, which acquired the Blue Air brand in 2016, is traded on Dutch exchanges, dipped about 0.2%. Today, if you've had to buy one or three, as in my house, you know air purifiers are not cheap, but neither is living with air pollution of the kind we see back east today. A 2021 study from the Natural Resources Defense Council, which is an environmental advocacy group you might have heard of, found the pollution from fossil fuels alone costs each American about $2,500 a year in extra medical bills. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We got a sense of how leaders of some of the biggest companies in this economy are feeling about the economy today, courtesy of the Business Roundtable's CEO Economic Index. Short answer? Meh. It's a quarterly survey, this thing is, of 143 of the Roundtable's member CEOs, including the likes of Tim Cook from Apple, Lachlan Murdoch from Fox. They collectively predict GDP growth at 1.5% this year. So again, that's kind of meh. Much attention is paid to what high-profile CEOs like this say about the economy, even if they're not, you know, actual economists. Question is, should that attention be paid? Marketplace's Matt Levin has this one.
By his own admission, Harry Kramer wasn't some type of macroeconomic clairvoyant back when he was a CEO.
I would say, hey, I think that the dollar is going to get a lot stronger, and so maybe we ought to be moving more production internationally. And it turned out, you know, the dollar didn't get a lot stronger.
Kramer ran a medical device manufacturer that's a Fortune 500 company. He doesn't think CEOs are any better at predicting the vagaries of the global economy than, say, a trained economist, but he says they're not any worse either. That's partly because CEOs operate in the real world with access to real-time data. Think how much Visa knows about consumer spending or Chevron knows about oil production.
They're on the ground and they're gathering data as well. That we may not get for like 2 or 3 months after the government's collected it and cleaned it and all these kinds of things.
Dana Peterson is chief economist with the Conference Board. There's also just a self-fulfilling aspect to CEO predictions. If a CEO thinks we're headed towards recession, maybe they hold back on hiring or building that factory. But Fitch Ratings economist Olu Sonola warns not to put too much stock into how CEOs of gigantic corporations are feeling. They're not the whole economy.
Small businesses are very, very important to what's going on in this economy. You know, you're talking 40% of output, employment, and the like.
Sonola says CEOs also tend to be more optimistic than economists. You know what they say. The future looks pretty bright from the window of that private corporate jet. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Kristen Schwab did brick-and-mortar retail for us earlier in the program. Now, we're going to go over to the e-commerce side. If you shop on TikTok or Instagram, you are probably familiar with what are known as dupes. That's short for duplicates. Supposedly cheaper lookalikes of things like Lululemon leggings or UGG boots, furniture, too. That's the short version. The longer version is that the dupe industry, because that's what it kind of is, an industry, isn't just about finding cheap alternatives. Sangeeta Singh Kurtz is a senior writer at The Cut, where she wrote about the world of dupes and her own foray into it. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
I would like to begin by having you tell me the tale of your search for a dupe for a, I guess it was like $1,500 or $1,600 mirror from Anthropology.
Oh no, this is an embarrassing place to start.
That's why I picked it.
But happy to tell you. Yeah, so I sort of let myself fall down the dupe rabbit hole on TikTok. I happen to like this extremely expensive mirror from Anthropology. And it kind of looks ridiculous in retrospect. Like, it was never going to look good. But I thought at the time, like, wow, you know, in these videos, I like the look of it. So I went dupe hunting, only to find that almost every dupe was sold out, or when I left TikTok and actually researched the dupe, it looked like crap. This was about 2 hours of my life that I'm never going to get back.
Yeah.
And I was frustrated, and I found this influencer who has millions of followers, and I bought a mirror from her Amazon storefront, and it was garbage.
All right. So we're going to leave that tale right there. We will come back to it because I just can't not. But let's do a little ground truth here. Dupes, duplicates, right? Not counterfeits, but duplicates of a given product.
You know, I would say that they also include counterfeits and knockoffs. It's sort of a Gen Z destigmatized rebranding of fakes, but fake goods definitely fall under the dupe umbrella. The term sort of was born in the cosmetics world in the early 2000s. And if you look at old makeup forums, you'll see the word being dupe used, how you just said it, you know, a duplicate. It's just, it looks similar to sold out or limited edition shades. The way that dupes moved into the sort of clothing, electronics, and shoes world, when it did that, the definition changed. And the basic money-saving definition sort of got lost. So now you see dupes that either barely save you money, or they're more expensive than the original product, or they don't even look like the original product.
Right.
It's gotten to the point where the logic of dupes has been sort of flipped on its head, and people are spending more time, and in some cases more money, dupe hunting than they would if they just bought the original.
Okay, so now help me understand the idea of dupes and the world of influencers, like the woman whose mirror you bought.
Sure. Yeah. So on TikTok, I don't know how much time you spend on TikTok, but there is a sort of culture.
clearly not as much as many, but anyway, go ahead.
It's probably for the best, but there's sort of a culture of savviness. It's not about buying something great. It's not about saving money. It's about going viral.
Wow.
And there's a financial incentive for this. You know, Amazon has a really attractive affiliate program where influencers can direct their audiences to their Amazon storefront. And the influencer makes commission off of purchases. And most websites do this too.
Tell me then about the end of your search for the mirror.
Well, it was garbage. I returned it. And I'm going back to the drawing board. I will not be taken in again by dupes. But I think at one point, when they were still sort of earnest product recommendations, and maybe this was, I'm going to say it was a couple of years ago before it really exploded, I might have been able to find a pretty good dupe of this particular mirror. But the way it is now, I was recommended something that, like, I stood in front of it and it looked like I was in a funhouse. Like, it was,
wow.
it was barely even a mirror. So it was a hard lesson learned.
Sagita Singh Kurtz, writing in The Cut not too long ago about the world of dupes. It's tough out there, man, looking for dupes. Sangeeta, thanks. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
There's economic uncertainty in the macro sense. We talk about that all the time, right? Just today, in fact, in Matt Levin's story a little bit ago about how CEOs are feeling. There's also, though, economic uncertainty in the micro sense, how people are feeling about their own economies. And the weeks and months after graduating college can be a time of peak uncertainty for young people entering the workforce or hoping to. Here is the last of our mini-series on those new graduates from our series, My Economy.
My name is Troy Swinar. I'm from Avon, Ohio, and I recently graduated from Ohio State University. My plans now are I would like to move to LA. My personal goal is to be there by August, but I don't want to move without a job. So I really hope to get a job by the end of the summer and have just a starting position out in the entertainment industry. Uniquely in the entertainment industry, there is currently the writer's strike, which shut down a lot of the current productions and such, so it slowed down a lot of openings, but at the same time, it almost reassured me in the sense of, one, you know, people are fighting for kind of a better career eventually for me, but also, if I got something early, I would have been one of the first ones to go in terms of, you know, once they start doing layoffs and cutting jobs, that probably would have been one of the jobs that I would have gotten before graduating if I had gotten anything. In terms of kind of, you know, becoming your own financial person, coming out of college, moving across the country, away from my parents and stuff, it is a daunting and overwhelming prospect, but I'm lucky enough to have the support of my parents in that sense of they are very much of the mindset of, you know, your 20s are for experimenting. We want you to find something that you love. Whatever you think you should pursue, we'll back you for it. I definitely don't want to, you know, crutch on that. I think it's important to, you know, be able to support myself, especially in such an expensive endeavor, you know, moving out west into an expensive city. But it's something that I've set my mind to. I really want to have a career in this industry, and I'm prepared to do whatever I gotta do in order to make those ends meet. If college, if COVID, God, has taught me anything, is that so much can change in a year. Even my own thing of I started college as a history major, and then halfway in, I was like, I love entertainment and this creative side that I've discovered so much. This is what I want to do. And maybe it'll change. But right now, I don't have, like, a fallback, a concrete fallback plan. And believe me, I know how crazy that is to say of, you know, there is no plan B. We'll wing this. But maybe that's because I do too much improv, and that's always sort of the thing of like, nah, we'll wing it. We'll do it live.
Gotta love that, right? Troy Swinhart taking that yes and improv attitude from Columbus, Ohio, all the way out here to LA. If your career plan has no plan B, or maybe you are working your way through plans C, D, and E, tell us about it. We'll put it on the radio. Marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, a very quick observation about the dirty and dangerous air that is besieging much of the Northeast United States. Something like 10% of all the economic activity in this country is generated in and around New York City. So if the people there can't breathe, well, the rest kind of writes itself, right? All right, we're out of here. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, a little geopolitics with your economic news. Wheat futures jumped a bit more than 3% yesterday on the news of that dam breach in Ukraine, down just a little bit today. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.